Nashai Makunda Radha Kunda Giti Govardhana Kijai Vrindavan Dhamma Kijai Mathura Dhamma Kijai Navajit Mayapur Dhamma Kijai Jagannapuri Dhamma Kijai Vrindavan Juna Devi Kijai Bhakti Devi Kijai Tulsi Maharani Kijai Samabhaita Bhakti Vrinda Kijai Gaura Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru Jamaka. All glories to Sri Guru Jamaka. Srimati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. June 26, 2014, in Lisbon, Portugal. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Divinity and Divine Service, Text 19. You can try to repeat, perhaps. Tada Rajastamo Bhava.
Tada Rajastamo Bhava.
Kamaloba Dayaschaye.
Kamaloba Dayaschaye.
Cheta Etar. Anavidam.
Chitta itai anavidam.
Stitam sattve prasidati.
Stitam sattve prasidati.
Tada.
Tada.
At that time.
At that time.
Rajaha.
Rajaha.
In the mode of passion.
In the mode of passion.
Tamaha.
Tamaha.
The mode of ignorance.
In the mode of ignorance.
Bhavaha.
Bhava.
The situation.
The situation.
Kama, lust and desire.
Kama, lust and desire.
Loba.
Loba.
Hankering.
Hankering.
Adaya.
Adaya.
Others.
Others.
Cha.
Cha.
And.
And.
Yay.
Yay.
Whatever they are.
Whatever they are.
Cheta.
Cheta.
The mind.
The mind.
Etai.
Etai.
By these.
By these.
Anavidam.
Anavidam.
Without being affected.
Without being affected.
Stitam.
Stitam.
Being fixed.
Being fixed.
Sattve.
Sattve.
In the mode of goodness.
In the mode of goodness.
Prasiddhati.
Prasiddhati.
Thus becomes fully satisfied.
Thus becomes fully satisfied.
So the previous verses were telling us how to come to the state of nishta and defining the state of nishta. And now we're getting some of the effects. What are you experiencing? So this is what you asked yesterday. So what do you get when you go there? Translation. As soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's modes of passion and ignorance, such as lust, desire, and hankering, disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness, and he becomes completely happy. So, remember again how much of the inartas have been removed here?
How much of that?
How much of the dirty things in the heart have been removed?
50%.
50%. Yeah. Purport. A living being in his normal constitutional position is fully satisfied in spiritual bliss. This state of existence is called Brahma-bhuta or Atmanadi, or the state of self-satisfaction. This self-satisfaction is not like the satisfaction of the inactive fool. So this is not like the satisfaction somebody feels, you know, taking marijuana or drinking beer and watching the World Cup.
I'm satisfied.
It's not like that. The inactive fool is in a state of foolish ignorance, whereas the self-satisfied Atmanandi is transcendental to the material state of existence. This stage of perfection is attained as soon as one is fixed in irrevocable devotional service. So irrevocable means it can't be taken away by anything outside of yourself. You could still leave. Your free will isn't gone. But there's nothing external to you that can take it away. Devotional service is not inactivity, but the unalloyed activity of the soul. So we shouldn't think this kind of self-satisfaction means you're not doing anything. The soul's activity becomes adulterated in contact with matter, and as such, the diseased activities are expressed in the form of lust, desire, hankering, inactivity, foolishness, and sleep. The effect of devotional service becomes manifest by complete elimination of these effects of passion and ignorance. The devotee is fixed at once in the mode of goodness. Now, here's another indication that this is that the state that's being discussed here is an intermediate state. It's not the final state. So Prabhupada's saying here, the devotee is fixed at once in the mode of goodness, and he makes further progress to rise to the position of Vasudeva, or the state of unmixed sattva, or sudasattva. So this is very interesting, because this state we're talking about here, being fixed, although you're fixed in goodness and you're not disturbed by passion and ignorance are still there. Otherwise, we wouldn't be rising to unmixed goodness. Does this make sense to everybody? If I say, from this state, you're going to go to unmixed goodness, where there's no passion and ignorance. So that means this is still a state of a mixture. It's still a mixture. But you're not disturbed by passion and ignorance anymore. Okay. Only in the sudasattva state can one always see Krishna eye to eye by dint of pure affection for the Lord. So until you're in pure, absolutely pure goodness, you're not going to be seeing Krishna eye to eye 100% of the time. A devotee is always in the state of, always in the mode of unalloyed goodness, therefore he harms no one. But the non-devotee, however educated he may be, is always harmful. A devotee is neither foolish nor passionate. The harmful, foolish, and passionate cannot be devotees of the Lord, however they may advertise themselves as devotees by outward dress. A devotee is always qualified with all the good qualities of God. Quantitatively, such qualifications may be different, but qualitatively, both the Lord and his devotee are one and the same. Tata rajas tamo bhava kamalo bhadayas chaye cheta ekar anavedam stitam sattve prasiddhati. As soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's mode of passion, ignorance, such as lust, desire, and hankering, disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness, and he becomes completely happy. So who remembers from the last 2 days, how do we get to this stage? What do we have to do to get to this stage?
By serving the pure devotee.
Serve the pure devotee. What else?
Serve the spiritual master.
Serve the spiritual master. What else?
Being humble.
Being humble and especially truthful.
Yes,
he must be truthful. Regularly hearing the Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
Occasionally devotional service.
At hearing and chanting. Shinvatam Swakatapashana, especially hearing and chanting. Punya Shravanam Kirtana. So especially hearing about Krishna with attention and respect. So hearing and chanting about Krishna with attention and respect. Regularly serving the Bhagavatam, and regularly serving great devotees and being truthful. So those things bring us to this state. And you have to have all of them. If you're just hearing and chanting neglectfully, or you're hearing and chanting and you're not willing to be truthful, or you're hearing and chanting without a mood of service, then it's not going to be effective. Or it will take a very, 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 very long time. But until one is hearing and chanting with attention, respect, and service, and truthfulness, things don't really go. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what happens when we achieve this state? What are the symptoms? We're going to look at the different list of symptoms here. So the first one is quite interesting, that although you're only 50% in goodness, that the effects of passion and ignorance basically are gone. They're still there, but they can't affect you much anymore. You're not so much affected by them. You know, it's something like recovering from a disease. You reach a point where you're not fully healthy yet, but where you don't have to lie in bed anymore. You know, you're not vomiting anymore. You don't have a fever anymore. You're still weak. You don't have your full strength. But the really negative effects of the disease are over. So the passion ignorance are still there. There's still 50% passion ignorance in the heart of the devotee. But they're not very affected by it. They're not controlled by it anymore. It's not a big deal. One way to think about this practically is before reaching this stage, you'll find that devotees tend to be very absorbed in getting free of Maya. We see this in the kind of articles submitted to Back to Godhead. People will write articles with what's wrong with material life, what's wrong with the material world. The material world is so bad. I mean, people talking very negatively, but most of the talk is very negative. That, you know, Maya's bad, material desires are bad, you can't have any happiness in the material world. It tends to be that sort of focus. Because again, the stage right before this is anartha nivritti, when you're becoming aware of your own contaminations. And it tends to be quite absorbing. You tend to be absorbed in getting rid of your contaminations. Again, you could look at it as cleaning a very dirty room. You go to a room that hasn't been cleaned for 50 years, and you know the previous owner was a pack rat and it was full of stuff. And so it's really hard to enjoy the room. Let's say it was a really beautiful room. But you're not really relishing the room. You're just absorbed in the dirt, and all you're seeing is dirt. And at a certain point of cleaning, the room starts to manifest. You start to enjoy the room. And the cleaning, you're much more focused on the positive than on the negative. Mm-hmm. So at this point, at Nishta, you're primarily focused on the positive. You're primarily focused on how wonderful Krishna is. You're not primarily focused on your anarthas anymore. In fact, at this stage, you're not particularly concerned about your anarthas anymore. This is also a stage of fixed faith. So at this point, you've gotten faith that not only are your anarthas not particularly bothering you, they're not really impeding your devotional service anymore. They're there, but they're not much of an impediment. You're able to chant and hear without being disturbed by this lust hankering and envy, and it's not blocking you so much anymore. It's there, but it's not a major thing. And another point is that you're not so concerned about it anymore because you have faith. You're not so concerned. Why don't you guys all move like a lot forward?
Because
there's not very many of us. I have no mic, and people are making a lot of noise.
Yeah. We have to close the door.
Have doors to close, so that would be very interesting. Very interesting to try to close the non-existent doors.
Oh,
that door. But some of the noise is coming from here. So again, think of it like a disease. So if you have a disease and you're going to a doctor, and you're following the doctor, and you're halfway cured, then you don't worry about, is it a good doctor anymore? You know, your first few visits, you might be really worried. Is this really a good doctor? Am I really going to get well? Is it really going to work?
Patience.
Oh, very good. So that was music matching the discussion. But after you're 50% well, you don't worry like that anymore. You have confidence. You have faith. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're halfway there, then you get confidence, I'm going to get the rest of the way there. Your faith becomes strong, and you let go of most of your anxiety and worry and concern. You know, am I going to reach the goal? Can you sit closer for me?
Yes.
Because I have no mic, there's a lot of noise. Thank you. Here, there you go. So, you like what Uba Goswami said, utsaha nishchaya daryat, to be have confidence, enthusiasm, and patience. So it becomes very easy to be confident, enthusiastic, and patient at this point because you have practical evidence that the process is working. You're experiencing it on a regular basis that the practice is working. So I remember one devotee saying, you know, I've gone above the modes of nature. I'm experiencing it, that it works, it's real. So you have this confidence. You're not plagued by a lot of doubts. There's still some doubts, because again, you're only 50% pure, but it's, again, they're no longer major things. They may come, and doubts may come, but they're not overwhelming you. You don't become overwhelmed by doubts. You don't become overwhelmed by discouragement. You're not wondering anymore, well, should I do this, should I do that? Your indecision is gone. So the indecision that happens before this stage, should I do this, should I do that? Should I live in Portugal or should I live in Vrindavan? Should I get married, should I not get married? Should I do this, should I do that? Those sort of things are gone. The absorption with the externals. I have to change this in my life, I have to change this. If only I change this in my life, I'd be Krishna conscious. If only I change this in my life. If only I could get rid of this troublesome person. If only I could do this. That's gone. That's just gone. That you realize that the real situation is internal and you're no longer very concerned with the external world. Then we have this great happiness, placidity. And Srila Prabhupada in the purport talks about atmanandi, or being self-satisfied. So there's all these verses in the Bhagavad Gita about this state of self-satisfaction. That you're no longer concerned with the externals because you have satisfaction internally. And Krishna uses words like atmarati. Rati means love. Rati literally is the name of the wife of Cupid. So such love for the self. All of us would like to like ourselves. It's one of the things that we all desire to do. We all desire to feel satisfied with ourselves and to like ourselves. So before this state, we don't really like ourselves. We pretend to like ourselves. We make a show of liking ourselves, you know, but we don't really like ourselves. We look in our heart and we go, oh my God, this is just awful. We lament our mistakes and we lament our failures. At this point, that's gone. That's gone. So you really like yourself because you start seeing your real self. And you see that your real self is really nice. You still don't like the dirt that's there. Again, you've cleaned the room enough so that you're starting to see the room, and you start to see how beautiful the room is. You start to see that, wow, the room is like, this room is kind of nice even. You know, it has beautiful designs on the ceiling. And so if you've gone to one of these old buildings from some very rich person, and it's, you know, covered with gold and painting and carving, right? It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful room. And sometimes these old mansions fall into disrepair. And as they're repaired, the beauty starts to emerge. Or restoring a painting that's become dirty, it starts to emerge. Right? So what's happened at this stage is you see enough of your real self that you really like yourself. You still lament the dirt that's remaining, but it's not your preoccupation. You're not obsessed with it. It's there, and you're taking care of it. But you're like, okay, I know I'm going to take care of it. And you start feeling satisfied with the real self. You start genuinely... Can you come a little closer? Can you come a little closer?
Coming to the room.
Yes.
How are your knees today?
Yeah, it's okay, but I don't want the source.
It should be okay now. Try to sit on the floor, see how you feel.
Huh?
Try it.
Try it.
How is it?
It's good.
Good. Can you sit on the floor now?
It's okay.
Is it good?
It's good.
Good. So at this point, you're satisfied with yourself. I'm a good person. I'm a soul. I'm part of Krishna. You look at yourself and you say, this is good. You look at yourself and say, I like myself. Actually, I love myself. And Krishna says you relish and rejoice in the self. You actually have a party seeing yourself. Wow! Look at me! Which is what we all would like to do. We would all like to say, I'm a wonderful person. And at this point, you really feel, I'm a wonderful person. I'm part of God. I'm a spiritual being. So you feel love for yourself, you feel satisfied with yourself, you feel enlightened with yourself, and as Prabhupada's saying here, you actually have good qualities. You actually start to manifest genuine good qualities. You start to manifest compassion. You start to manifest empathy. You start to manifest selflessness. You start to manifest poetry. All the good qualities that are natural to souls start to be there. Now, they're not fully manifest. They can only be fully manifest when there's no more passion in it. But they start to be manifest enough that you can enjoy them. You know, we enjoy when we're good, don't we? When we do something that's good, don't we enjoy that?
Mm-hmm.
So one starts to relish that. One starts to relish one's own goodness. one's own part of Krishna, one's own spirituality. Does this all make sense? So what else happens in the mode of goodness? So the mode of goodness, it says all the gates of the body are illuminated by knowledge. That means one hears and sees and smells and tastes things as they are. So again, you know, it's partial. You can think of it as a window that's clean enough so that you can see out of it. It's not completely cleaned. Or like in a car when you take the fog off the windshield. It's not, the whole windshield isn't clean. But the part that's not cleaned is at the edges. So you can start to see things as they are. You see things accurately. In passion and ignorance, we don't see things accurately at all. Our view of reality is extremely distorted. We believe that we're seeing reality, but we're not at all. We're seeing through a very selfish, self-centered view and a feeling of emptiness. You know, in passion and ignorance, you actually hate yourself. You're envious of yourself. You're full of bad qualities. All you're thinking about is your own needs. I need this, I need that, I lack this, I lack that. You see other people in terms of friends and enemies. You see the world as aggressive and painful and difficult, and life is difficult, which is all a bunch of nonsense. None of that is true at all. But you're seeing through this film, this distortion. So when one comes to the platform of being fixed, one just doesn't perceive things like that anymore. One doesn't perceive, this is my friend, this is my enemy. One perceives, everybody is my friend. Everybody is a part of Krishna. Nobody can hurt me. Nobody can help me. Nobody can hurt me. I have everything that I need. I mean, if someone helps you, you're grateful. And if someone tries to hurt you, you're compassionate. But you're not affected by it. You see that God is everywhere. You see that God is in every atom. You see that God is in everyone's heart. You may not see that at this point, like Krishna Prabhupada says, you can't fully see it face to face because there's still some contamination there. But you become aware of it. Oh, thank you. As one devotee said to me, I don't always see Krishna, but I can feel him. I can feel that he's present. This devotee said, she said, sometimes I can see him. Oh, actually, I want that. Here, I want that. Thank you. She said, sometimes I can see him, but I can always feel him. I always feel a connection. Another devotee said the same thing to me. He said, you know, are you able to always feel that Krishna is there, that the connection is not broken? So at this stage, one can feel that God is there, even if one cannot always see him. And one may see him at least sometimes. One can feel God is in everyone's heart, God is in every atom, and I am a part of him. And one feels happy. Everything is perfect. Everything is right. Everything is just. Everything is fair. One knows, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, what should be done and what should not be done. One is binding and one is liberating. So when one's in passion and ignorance, if you don't know what to do, so do I do this? Do I do that? One doesn't have a sense of what action will be best for me. That we think some things will be good for us, we do them and they're terrible. And we think some things will be bad for us and we end up doing them and end up being wonderful. And we don't know. We can't judge what's a good action and what's a bad action. But at this point, one can judge, one can tell. This will be something that's good and this will be something that's bad. We have proper discrimination. Now, let's see some other things that Krishna says about the mode of goodness. Okay, we talked about that one sees that in every living entity, everyone is an equal soul. We don't see differences. Our actions are then performed without attachment, without love or hatred. We're no longer attached to the results of our actions. We're getting pleasure at every moment, regardless of the results. Our pleasure is coming from our action at every moment. Whether it's success or failure becomes irrelevant to us. Our actions are without false ego. We're not thinking I'm the doer, I'm great. With great determination and enthusiasm. Our determination and enthusiasm is not determined by external situations. It's not determined by success or failure. So in passion, we're determined when we get a good result, and as soon as we don't think we're going to get a good result, we become discouraged. In ignorance, we don't have any determination. But in goodness, one is determined regardless, because one is getting one's reward at every moment. So without wavering in success or failure. I thought we talked about that one. Okay, let's look in the 17th chapter where there's also some list of goodness. Okay, we talked about food. One is naturally attracted to healthy, nourishing food. Actually, a person in this state no longer enjoys unhealthy food. They lose their taste for it. They're only going to eat things which are really nourishing to their body. Whatever sacrifices they do are going to be out of for purification. And the sacrifice itself will be pleasurable. So in passion, the pleasure is pleasurable and the sacrifice is painful. In ignorance, everything is painful. And in goodness, everything is pleasurable. You don't see a difference between the sacrifice and the result. It's all pleasure. And you're not doing the sacrifice to get some result. You're doing the sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice, for the sake of connection with Krishna. Okay, you naturally engage in goodness austerity. You naturally worship the Lord and superiors. You're naturally clean. You start liking things that are clean. You become nonviolent. You don't hurt anybody. You don't want to hurt anybody. You don't get any pleasure from hurting anybody. You're able to speak truth. You speak in a way that helps others. Your speech becomes pleasing. Your mind becomes satisfied, and your mind becomes purified. You end up giving charity, though this is charity of both time and money and energy. It's not just charity of money. You give charity in a way that fills your heart with joy. You do it voluntarily. You basically lose the sense of feeling forced. And you get a sense of that what I'm doing voluntarily. The sense of have to and should disappear. And it becomes, this is something I'm doing because it's because I want to do it, because it's the right thing to be done. And you feel satisfied with your giving in charity. You give in charity to the right people at the right time and the right place in a way that fills you with satisfaction. So these are some of the symptoms of the mode of goodness. And it's explained in the next verse that one receives positive scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead. So one really starts to understand Krishna. One doesn't understand Krishna just theoretically. One starts to really realize Krishna at this stage. And then the next verse, the knot in the heart is pierced and all misgivings are cut to pieces. So again, doubts, difficulties, they're just cut into pieces by your practical experience. The chain of fruitive actions is terminated. One is no longer bound by karma. The chain is cut. When one sees oneself as master. So again, you're seeing the soul. You're seeing the glory of the soul. So those are the different symptoms that are mentioned here. And of course, one feels free. At this point, one is essentially liberated. One is not fully liberated, but for all intents and purposes, one is liberated. You can think of it like a prisoner. So another explanation of the state, we've given several different explanations, the fog on the windshield, the healthy the patient getting healthy, the room getting clean. Another analogy would be a prisoner. So a prisoner may have a prison sentence of 30 years, but if the prisoner behaves, they may get out early on parole. Yes, you're all familiar with this? They come in front of the parole board and the parole board says, okay, you can get out early. So then you're let out of the prison. Now, when you let out of the prison early, you're out of the prison. You're a free person, but you're not 100% free. You have to check in with the parole board. There's some conditions for your freedom. But as long as you follow those conditions, nobody can arrest you again. So this is what is meant by irrevocable. So you can still mess up, but nothing external is going to mess you up. Before this stage, external things mess you up. You're trying to be a devotee and if there's some difficulty, you lose your faith or you lose your enthusiasm or something like that. But at this stage, that's not the case. So you're free. The person on parole is walking around like an ordinary citizen. They're able to do most, not all, but most of the things an ordinary citizen can do, although they have some restrictions. They may have some restrictions on travel. Generally, they have restrictions just on criminal activity. Generally, it's like, okay, you know, don't take any drugs, don't sell any drugs, don't steal anything. And you'll, you know, if you do those things again, then you're back in prison again. But as long as you don't commit, but they're watching you more carefully, huh? It's just like the government isn't carefully watching me. I don't have to check in regularly with any government official. They're not tracking me. I don't think so. Anyway. Who knows nowadays when anybody's doing. But when you're on parole, you're trapped. You have to check in at least once a month with your parole officer. They're watching what you're doing. They're not just completely trusting you. They're partially trusting you, but they're not completely trusting you. But still, you feel free. You're out of prison. You're free. Your experience is basically that of freedom. So the devotee at this stage is also having this experience of freedom. And then, as we said earlier, starting at this stage, everything comes very easily and naturally. You're more in a flow. You're still making some effort at this stage. It's not that the effort is gone, but the effort becomes very easy. It becomes an easy flow. Now, at this stage, thinking of Krishna is still not the default value. That happens a little higher stage at Ashakti. So there's still a tendency to go to Maya at this stage. But it's very easy to bring yourself back. That's the difference. So before this stage, there's a tendency to go to Maya, and it's very difficult to bring yourself back. At this stage, there's still a tendency to go to Maya, but you very quickly notice it, and you come back very easily. Before this stage, you may not notice it for a long time. You may be in Maya for days or weeks or months before you realize that you're in Maya. And then it's a great endeavor to get yourself back to the road. At this stage, you notice very, very quickly that you're in Maya when you're in illusion. And you come back very, very quickly. Passion and ignorance are still there, but they're not strong. Okay, so questions, comments? I'm sure there's more symptoms, but I think this is...
So when you said in the beginning that the devotee, that he concentrates himself or herself in get rid of the nardas and things like that, you know, then can explain sometimes the devotee is feeling like, you know, everyone is in their own you know, life and things like that, and there's not much how do you say this? Humanistic side of things.
Because people are so absorbed in getting rid of their own anarchists. It really, that's a good idea. I like that idea. You know, basically, until you're at this point, you're very self-absorbed. You know, you're really quite self-absorbed. I mean, even materialistic people are really very self-absorbed. Even if they're interacting in community and so forth. So yes, it's a fact. When people are in the anartha nivritti stage, they're very self-absorbed. In fact, they have to be to a large extent. They need to be. It's like when you're extremely sick, you become self-absorbed, yes? Don't we all become very self-absorbed when we're very sick?
Uh-huh.
And you almost have to be. You almost have to be. You have to be really focusing on your treatment. It's just necessary. What can be done?
And another thing is that how you said that, you know, you after getting rid of the like 50% of the anarchy, so you feel like I'm wonderful and this and that.
Yeah.
What's the relation between that feeling that and the, you know, the guides of the acharyas that, you know, I'm lower than these, lower than that.
That's such a great question. You'll notice that when the acharyas talk about how low and fallen that they are, they generally, almost always, combine it with a celebration of the real self and the mercy that they're getting. So if you look at the verses of Krishnadas Kaviraj, he's got two verses. I'm lower than the worm in the stool. Anyone who says my name becomes sinful. I'm more fallen than Jagai and Madai. And that's within about 15 or 16 verses where he is just celebrating the mercy that he's getting. I've seen Lord Nityananda, I'm serving Radha Shyam in Vrindavan, And he's going on and on and on. He says, this Lord Nityananda, he doesn't have any discrimination because he's giving mercy to such a fallen person, or such a fallen person as myself. So let's say that you're a really, really bad criminal, okay? Let's just say. Just imagine someone who's a really, really bad criminal. They've murdered 10 people. They've raped 10 people. They've burned down houses. I mean, they're really bad. The kind of criminal that people say, you know, put them in jail forever. And somehow or other, when they're in jail, they come to spiritual life. Somebody comes and teaches them about spiritual life, and they truly repent, and they truly change themselves, and they're let out of prison. What will they say? They'll rejoice in their new self. But a lot of their rejoicing in their new self is in comparison to their old self. It's just like if you're extremely, extremely, extremely sick. I remember years ago, I had a very high fever. I had such a high fever that I was hallucinating. I was delirious. And it was hellish. I mean, I had some days I was just going in and out of consciousness all day. I couldn't, like, stay awake. I was dreaming while I was awake. And I had such bad pain in my ear. I was thinking my ear was broken. And I couldn't speak at all. I mean, I was quite sick.
Like malaria, huh?
I wasn't malaria, but I was really, really, really sick. So finally I went to the doctor, and they gave me some medicine. And within, it was one of those things where within a few hours I felt better. It took me a month to get well, but within a few hours I felt better. So you're seeing both. How wonderful it is that such a sick person as I has become well. How amazing it is that somebody who was that sick has become well. So your rejoicing is very much connected with your understanding the fallen state. And you don't see, you see your wonderfulness as mercy, not as an effect of your own effort and endeavor. Even if your own effort is involved, it's still mercy if you're paroled early. You know, no matter how good you are in the prison, you cannot force the jailers to parole you early. They have to decide to parole you early. It's their mercy. Now, they're responding to your effort, but they don't have to respond to your effort. It's still mercy. So you don't think, oh, I'm such a great person that I was able to get out of jail. I was such a fallen person, and by their mercy, I've been released. And by their mercy, I'm now experiencing freedom. So it's both like that. You're seeing both. In fact, if you're not seeing both, it's just tamagun. It's just ignorance. If you're just sitting going, oh, I'm so fallen, I'm so bad, I'm so miserable, I'm so this, I'm so that, that's just not ignorance. That's not pleasing. I mean, think another way you can think about it, let's say someone in your life has really, really offended you. Do we all have somebody like that? Someone who's like really, really messed up in our life? Everybody have somebody like that? Somebody who like cheated you or lied to you or offended you or really hurt you in some way? And if that person comes to apologize, so you want them to feel bad about what they did, yes? If they just come and say, hey, can I be your friend again? You're going to, wait a minute. So it's necessary for them to feel, I really hurt you. I really offended you. I really cheated you. I caused you pain. But if you're accepting them back, it's also very joyful, isn't it? Right? Or let's think of it when we're the offender. So if we've ever offended anyone, I'm sure none of you have offended anyone, but I have. So if we've ever really offended somebody, and you know, if we've ever really messed up, like really, really messed up, somebody that we love, somebody that we care about, someone we want a relationship with, and we really did something wrong, we really mistreated that person, we let them down, we were irresponsible, and we realized, wow, what did I do? I really messed up. So if we go to that person, and if they accept us, you know, the picture I get is you come in their house, and you're sitting next to them, and their arm is around you, and you're crying. And you're saying, I'm so, so sorry that I hurt you. I'm so, so sorry that I did this. And their arm is around you and they say, that's okay, I love you. So you're simultaneously rejoicing and grieving, aren't you? Yes, so you're there and they're holding you and they're saying, it's okay, I forgive you, I love you, let's plan to have a picnic today, whatever, you know. And then you're starting a new life, and at the same time you're grieving. And maybe you're crying and you I'm so sorry. But that feeling of sorry is part of a connection with them. When it's like, I'm so sorry, I'm such an evil person, it's all about me. When I'm so sorry, I'm an evil person that hurt you, then it's about my relationship with you. And if you happens to be God, then that's very sweet, isn't it? Then I'm feeling that connection with Krishna, and I'm lamenting my fallen condition. So that is happening primarily in the Anartha Nivritti stage, that kind of lamentation. It's happening mostly in the Anartha Nivritti stage. Because that's when you're seeing all this stuff and you're lamenting about it. That's what's happening. And at this stage of Nishtha, that still happens sometimes. But it's much, much more about the relationship being wonderful than it is about the lamentation. The emphasis is shifting. And even in the lamentation, one is feeling much more joy. Does that make some sense to you? There's still going to be some lamentation. I mean, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he's with the devotees, and the devotees are saying, how wonderful it is that you're enjoying bhakti. And Sarvabhauma says, yes, Mahaprabhu has turned a crow into Garuda. So he's saying he's like Garuda. He's rejoicing, I'm like Garuda, but I was a crow. How wonderful, my Lord has turned a crow into Garuda. Without that humility, frankly, there's no love. If your mood is, I'm great and I deserve to be, then there's no happiness. That feeling of being undeserving is giving fuel to the joy, isn't it? Don't we enjoy more undeserved gifts than we do earned gifts? We get much more pleasure out of something that we buy on sale. When I get something that's worth more than I paid for it, I get much more pleasure than if I were get something that's worth what I paid for. So my feeling of deservedness is in inverse proportion to my happiness. The more I feel I deserve something, the less I enjoy it. If I get what I think I deserve, in fact, I don't really enjoy it at all. And if I get less than what I deserve, I become very angry. If I get more than what I deserve, I feel very happy and grateful. So love without humility is doesn't make any sense. You can't enjoy love without humility. I mean, this is a lot of what kills human relationships, is this feeling of deservedness. Mm-hmm. If I think, you know, I'm the wife, so I deserve for my husband to spend 4 hours a day with me, then if he spends 3 hours, you're not happy. you can't even appreciate it because you've decided that you deserve four. You follow? But if you say, I don't deserve anything, then if he spends 5 minutes with you, you're happy. Wow. Then you feel gratitude for everything. So when you think you deserve nothing, you feel gratitude for everything. Mm-hmm. One reason that the devotee at this point is relishing and being satisfied with the self is this feeling that I don't deserve it. So everything about the real self is wonderful. So these things are both there. I am wonderful, I am glorious, and I've done nothing to deserve this realization of my wonderful, glorious self. This uncovering of my wonderful, glorious self is a gift given to me. There's no effort that I could have made that would deserve such a wonderful thing. That there's no way I could have paid for this. That this is so wonderful and it's so amazing and it's so incredible that as one devotee said to me, when one achieves it, one sees that whatever payment was made is nothing. That whatever price one had to pay was well worth it. It was nothing. It was no price at all. You know, it's just like if someone has some terrible disease, and if they pay 1,000 euros, they become completely cured in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. They're going to say the 1,000 euros was nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I would have given everything for this. They see it as a gift. Yes, like that. Is that all right?
Yeah. People, I mean, especially in these new age, in these yoga clubs, and you know, all this, also speak like that. That we should deserve, we should do out of love, with expectation, things like that, you know. But we have the realization we need to practice spiritual life.
Well, the people who talk like this, that means that they're being influenced by the mode of goodness. That's what it means. People in the mode of ignorance are interested in immediate gratification with as little effort and sacrifice as possible, and without concern for future payment. Let me get whatever I want now for my immediate happiness with as little trouble as possible, and if I have to pay for it in the future, I'll worry about it then. And if I have to harm people, if what I'm doing is harming myself, if what I'm doing is harming others, I'll worry about that later. I just want it now. People in the mode of passion are saying, I want something that's good, and I want something that's pious, and I want something that's that will do good for me and others, and I'm willing to work really, really hard for it. And I hate my hard work, but I'm willing to do it because I'm such a good person that I'm willing to sacrifice for some result. But I want the credit. I want people to say, see how hard you sacrifice? See what a dedicated person you are? See what a good person you are? I want a lot of credit. I want to enjoy the fruits. Whatever I work for, I want to enjoy those fruits. Those are mine. I work for them. And I want credit. But I want to be a good person. I do think about the consequences of my activities, and I am willing to work hard for things. I'm not a thief. The person in the mode of ignorance is a thief. The person in the mode of passion is a person making a righteous payment. But the mood is still, I want enjoyment. But they're willing to delay enjoyment. And they're willing to work very, very hard. As long as they see the result. As soon as they don't see the result, they give up. Okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. Because everything's dependent on the fruit. So that's the mode of passion. And the mode of passion, people are very interested in morality, ethics, justice. These are the people most interested in charity, are the people in the mode of passion. Charity, good works. Good government, Raja, Gun. Raja is the king. So you think of the righteous king who's, you know, taking care of people. I'm the giver of benedictions to everyone. So in the mode of passion, you're building schools and hospitals and roads and giving a charity, and you're fixing this, and so you're fixing everything, but you're doing it for that sense of just see how good I am, just see what a good person I am. Everybody praise me. See how hard I've worked, see all my sacrifice, see what a good person I am. I am the doer, I've done all these good works, and they are here for me to enjoy. So that's the mode of passion. And the mode of goodness, and mode of passion, you're also interested in more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better. Mode of ignorance is like, give me something to eat now.
Give me what?
Give me something to eat now. You know. And mode of passion is bigger, better, more, more, good, good, bigger, better, more, more, more. Work hard, work hard, work hard for more, bigger, better. Whatever I get, I want more, I want more, I want more, I want more, I want bigger, I want better, I want more, I want bigger, I want better. And the mode of goodness is about balance. So ignorance and goodness are both about now. But ignorance is, I want sense gratification now, forget about the consequences. Goodness is, I already have happiness now. Goodness is about peace, balance, harmony, forgiveness, compassion. That's what goodness is about. People in goodness are very interested. People in goodness are interested in liberation, purification. They don't want to enjoy the world, but the mode of ignorance person wants to enjoy it by stealing now. The mode of passion person wants to have it by fixing the world and changing the world and being the big doer and the big achiever. And the person in the mode of goodness wants to do it by being in harmony with the world. Talking philosophy, talking poetry, You know, that's why a person in the mode of passion is also interested in art and culture. But the person in the mode of goodness is interested in art and culture for balance and for harmony and for forgiveness and for compassion. The person in the mode of goodness wants good qualities within. The person in the mode of passion wants to do good works externally. The person in the mode of passion, they want to build a hospital, they want to build a school, they want to send, you know, billions of euros to poor people in some war country. But they don't really care whether they experience compassion. That's not their interest. Their interest isn't internal compassion. Their interest is, see how many people I fed. I'm a great person. The person in the mode of goodness, they may also feed people, but their interest is, I want to feed people so I can develop compassion, so I can develop empathy, so I can become purified, so I can make me a better person. You know, like Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. That's a very sattva guna mentality. A Rajagun mentality is change the world. I am the doer to change the world. I'm already good. The person in the mode of passion, I'm already good. What do I need to become good for? I'm already great. Just see how great I am. And the person in the mode of ignorance also thinks like that. I'm already great. I'm perfect, powerful, and happy. The person in the mode of goodness is more, you know, let me become a good person. Let me become full of compassion. Let me become full of peace. Let me become full of harmony. Let me be the change I want to see in the world. And they're much more satisfied. The person in the mode of goodness is not thinking about more, bigger, better. They're thinking about balance and sustainability. They're thinking about maintenance. So yes, people who talk like that, they're talking the language of sattva-guna. They're more unusual in society. Most even religious people are just in Rajagun. Most religions in the world are teaching Rajagun with a little sattva-guna. They're basically teaching, you know, like 90% Rajagun, 10% sattva-guna. Be a good person in the world, do good works, take good care of your family, be a responsible person, get a good job, be a good citizen, pray to God. You know, but if people are talking about love your enemies, that's very sattva-guna. Be satisfied with whatever happens, that's sattva-guna. Have the courage to face everything that happens at every moment, that's very sattva-guna. Something bad happens, go and change it, go and fix it, that's rajagun. Is that clear? So yes, they are. That is sattva-guna. But sattva-guna is also material. It's also about me.
Talking about sattva-guna, how do you explain to people that they should work in a detached way? I mean, what's that mean in practical terms? For instance, like the boat is, they have this, you know, give some percentage or whatever, you know.
Well, the way I explain it, I don't know if this will help you or not, but the way I explain it is in terms of sacrifice and pleasure. So we all want pleasure, and we're pleasure seeking, and we all want different varieties of pleasure according to our past and present conditioning. We don't all want to enjoy the same thing. What you enjoy, I may not enjoy. And we enjoy different things at different times in our life. So the way the universe is set up is that enjoyment comes as a result of sacrifice. That's how everything is established. Krishna says, tapaso ridayam sakshat atmaham tapasa. Tapaso ridayam sakshat. Tapasya is directly in my heart. Atmaham tapasa. My very self is tapasya. And he says that sarvagatam brahma nitya yagya pratistitam. God is everywhere, but you find him in sacrifice. So God is the most joyful, but real joy is in sacrifice, is in loving sacrifice. Our greatest joy comes from loving sacrifice. So the ultimate reality is that everything comes from sacrifice. Krishna says, I create, maintain, and destroy by sacrifice. So if you try to enjoy without sacrifice, that is what we mean by stealing. That's exactly what we mean by stealing. I want to get something without a payment. How can a society be happy if everybody is stealing? Is that possible? Could you have a happy, peaceful society if everybody is stealing? Just like in South Africa, they have beautiful climate. They don't have any natural catastrophes in South Africa. They have no tornadoes, no hurricanes, no cyclones, no earthquakes, no volcanoes, no tsunamis. They have no natural catastrophes in South Africa. It's nice weather most of the year. A lot of the country has a year-round growing season. They have a long coastline. They have many natural resources like gold and diamonds. And I mean, the country is rich with metals, with jewels, with all different kinds of ores. They're one of the most natural resource-rich countries in the world. Again, they have a full facility for agriculture. I mean, it's just like a perfect place, practically. But because there's so much crime in the country, it's a miserable place to be. People are constantly in fear. And the buildings, practically all over the country, with a few exceptions, everybody has, you know, nobody has a window like that. The windows are all barred and locked, and the doors are barred and locked, and then around your property there's a high fence and a high wall and barbed wire and people with guns and dogs and everywhere it's like that. And almost everywhere. A few places are not, but almost everywhere it's like that. And everybody has a crime story, either themselves or a friend. Yeah, everyone's either been a victim of crime or a close friend or relative has been a victim of crime. Serious crime. You know, you talk to almost anybody. Well, yeah, the robbers came and they gave poison to our dogs and they, you know, came with their guns and stole all of our jewelry. And yeah, we used to get robbed once a year like that. And then we put up the high fence and now we haven't got robbed for the last 3 years. I mean, everyone, if it's not them, it's someone else. You know, if they didn't get it, then their father or their brother or someone like that. You know, so many people were raped. So many people, you know, I was raped. I talked to this one woman. I was raped and I got pregnant. And when the son was 22 years old, he was at a traffic light and somebody came with a gun and shot him in the head and took his car. And that's their reality. So how can you be happy in such a place? Is it possible? I mean, when I was in someone's house, if I said I want to sit outside in the yard to chant japa, oh, wait a minute, let me get my keys. You can't walk out of your door and sit in your own yard. Even though your yard has a fence around, your yard has a concrete wall. And on top of the concrete wall, there's barbed wire and glass.
It's like living in a prison.
It is. And then, you know, to get out of the concrete wall, there's a metal gate with a lock. And there's an alarm system, and the alarm system will alert people with guns. But still, you don't feel safe to sit in your yard with that kind of a barrier between your yard and the street. You don't feel safe to go from your house to the yard and leave the door to your house open. If you want to go to the yard, you have to unlock all the doors, and then when you sit in the yard, you have to lock all the doors to your house again. You're not just going to walk out of your house and pick some roses and walk back into your house. So if everybody's a thief, how can anybody be happy, is my point. If you have a society, everybody's stealing. How can you be happy? Okay. So then next higher is you pay for things. You say, I want this, I'll pay for it. You know, I want sex, I'll marry somebody, I'll have babies. That's what it means. You know, I want money, I'll have an honest job, I'll give taxes to the government, and I'll give charity to those who are in need. That's what it means to pay for things. So you want a certain kind of enjoyment, and then you do a certain sacrifice. But in that, that's Rajaguna, but there you're attached. You want to enjoy your work. So in Tamaguna, you can't enjoy anything, you're always in anxiety. In Rajaguna, you can enjoy your fruits. But your sacrifice feels like suffering. You know, you're working to make money. And you may enjoy your work, but your work still feels like a sacrifice. It feels like work. Your work feels like work. Your results feel like enjoyment, but your work feels like work. So you're getting this mixed happiness and distress. And most of the time, you're sacrificing. You're working, results. Working, results. The majority of your time is taken up in sacrifice. Work 5 days a week, 2 weeks, 2 days, weekend. And you're putting in much more sacrifice time than you're getting results. So your main life experience is sacrifice. And your sacrifice is painful. Your results are pleasurable. And then you may not get the result. You may work, and you don't get the result. You're never sure if you're going to get the result or not. You might not. Or you might get it and you don't like it. Or somebody else may take it, or whatever. So there's always some anxiety. And then as soon as you finish enjoying the result, it's over and you have to work again. So that's attached work. You do get to earn results, and you have much more happiness than the thief. But you have very temporary happiness. Your happiness is very temporary. The boundaries of your happiness are distressed. There's distress on either side of your happiness. You're never quite sure how much happiness you're going to get. Yeah, then there's detached work. In detached work, you say, the purpose of my work is not to enjoy this world. It's not to enjoy the fruits of my work. That is not the purpose of my work. The purpose of my work is to enjoy inner happiness. The purpose of my work is to realize myself. So I have some things I want to enjoy in this world, that's a fact, and I'm willing to sacrifice for them, but I'm not. My real enjoyment is not going to be the things of this world. My real enjoyment is going to be spiritual. So I'm not going to sacrifice exactly as a payment. I'm going to sacrifice as an act of giving to the proprietor of the store. So in the mode of ignorance, I'm stealing from the store. In the mode of passion, I pay at the store, but I don't care about the owner of the store. There's no relationship. It's just a store, and I just give my money, and I get my things, and I leave. So detached work is, I get a relationship with the owner of the store. And I pay my money to the store, not exactly as a payment. It's just like I often ask devotees to do service and give them a donation, and I never call it a payment. I always call it a donation, even if we decide that it's going to be a particular price. So even if they say, okay, I'm going to paint this picture for your book and I need $1,000 for it, I always say to them, you know, I'd like you to do some service. I'm willing to give you a donation. What donation would be appropriate? I never say I'm giving you a salary. Why? And many times it is a salary, it is a payment. But why do I change the language? Because I want to say that you're giving me a gift, I'm giving you a gift. This is a free exchange of love. It's like that if we pay our friends for something. I got a friend in Hawaii who sews the edges on my saris. Actually, she did this for free. But she does sewing for me where I pay her. But I don't think of it as a business exchange. She's my friend. Do you follow? So would you make new cushions for my deities? And I said, you know, I'll be happy to pay you something. What would you like? Well, I think that would, you know, I think I could do this for $15. Okay. But it's really about our relationship. It's not really about a payment. She's not really doing it for the money. And I'm not paying her just to get the thing like I would get in the shop. It's a relationship. And I find as much pleasure giving her the money as I find getting the cushions. I enjoy giving her the money. You all have this sort of circumstance. I enjoy giving her the money. I that is as much pleasure with me. When I give money in a shop, I do not enjoy giving the money at all. There's no pleasure with giving the money except to think that I'm a good person, that I'm not a thief. That's the only pleasure. That I'm an honest person. There's some sense that I'm an honest person. And I'm not stealing. But when I give money to a friend who's doing something for me, it's still an exchange. There's still an exchange going on. And I wouldn't give them the money just to give it to them. There's still some exchange. All right? I'm not just giving a gift, and they're not just giving a gift. It's not only about love. I also want something, and they also want something. But the act of exchanging itself is pleasure. So that's sattva-guna, material sattva-guna. In material sattva-guna, you still want an exchange. You still want the enjoyment. You're not just giving to give. But the act of giving becomes as pleasurable as the enjoyment. There becomes no defining line because it's all about your relationship with the Lord, who you may be seeing in sattva-guna is just Brahman or Paramatma. You're probably not seeing him as Bhagavan. But everything is about realizing myself and realizing Brahman. The giving is about it, and the pleasure is about it. It's all about that. I'm doing the sacrifice for purification, and I'm getting the results for purification, and it's all sweet. And you can't even tell anymore. What's the? Where does my sacrifice end and where does the enjoyment begin? So that's what we want. We want total enjoyment without sacrifice. That's what we're looking for. But in the, you only get it when you completely enjoy the sacrifice. How interesting. You don't get it in the motive ignorance. So that's detached work. You're not working for the result anymore, really. You're working for the relationship. Your motive becomes the relationship, the purification. Your motive no longer becomes the result. You're still interested in the result. It's just still material. But that's not your primary motive. That's not what really what's driving you. Nor do you think that you're the doer. And you don't exactly think, I'm paying for this. It's not like that. Like, we just visited an artist in Italy who's working on a book that I'm doing. And I'm giving him donations for his work. But when I saw the paintings, I wasn't thinking, well, I've paid for this. I wasn't thinking like that at all. I was just thinking how wonderful it is that someone else gave me the donation that I can now give to this person. I don't have a job, you know, where do I get that money from? I mean, someone else gives me the donation that I can then give to this person. And I can give something to this person that will help him in his life and in his spiritual life. And that he's absorbed in these paintings of Krishna that's helping him in his spiritual life. I was happy in his happiness. And he was happy in my happiness. Even though we wanted some result, I wanted the paintings. If he just said, thanks for the donation, I'm not going to do the paintings, that wouldn't have been very pleasant. But it wasn't a result-oriented thing. Is that clear? Then bhakti is even higher than that. In bhakti, you don't care about the results at all. Not at all. In the lower stages of bhakti, like right after this nista, there's ruchi, then you're just enjoying the act of the exchange. You're simply enjoying the process of exchanging. And at higher than that, asakti, bhava, and prema, you're just enjoying the person. You're just relishing the person. You don't really care what you're doing with them. You don't care what you're giving them, what they're giving you. It's just completely irrelevant. So in bhakti, in ruchi, you're relishing this exchange of love. And at ashakti and higher, you're just relishing the person. You don't care what you're doing. You don't care if you're giving them, you know, you can be giving them banana peels and they don't care. It's
they may even having an argument. The outside can look like,
yeah, oh yes, definitely,
nasty,
definitely.
But they're enjoying it themselves. Because
definitely, exactly. I love that. Thank you. That's really nice. That's really nice. Like Radha is sometimes arguing with Krishna.
Yes.
Or Mother Yasoda's chasing Krishna to tie him up.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. That's or the cowherd boys are fighting. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You just added a great. You just gave me a great gift. There. Thank you. Yeah, that becomes irrelevant. As long as you're with the person and you're making, and then there's that. That's all. And that's the ultimate detached work. Then what you're doing is irrelevant. Whether you do anything in the world, you don't do anything, it doesn't matter to you at all. What you're relishing at every moment, 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 now, is there's Krishna. So a little lower than that, what you're relishing every moment is I'm giving to Krishna. There's this exchange going on. You're relishing the exchange itself. You follow? And higher than that, you're just relishing the person. In a lower stage, the person is the medium for you to relish the exchange, and in a higher stage, the exchange is the medium for you relishing the person. So that's the ultimate detached work. The work itself is irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter. I mean, you're trying to do the work to please that person, but it's the pleasure of that person that's important. And you have nothing to gain. You have nothing to gain. You have nothing to lose. What fruit? Looking for fruit? What? I just want to love this person. We're talking about fruit. But at least if you can bring people to sattva, because in sattva, you're still selfish. You're still thinking about your purification. You're thinking about your liberation, your purification, your inner qualities. But that's a good platform. I mean, if you just stay there, then you take birth as a demigod, or if you have a lot of passion mixed, you'll take birth as a poet, a philosopher, a scientist on the earth. You know, it's not liberation itself. Like Jagatakaswami said, it's the airport, it's not the airplane. Is that all right? I think we should end here. We have a long journey today. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.